Welcome back to Radicalize Me, an activist podcast. My guest this week is the legendary activist Norman Solomon, founder of Roots Action and the Institute for Public Accuracy. Those are both great resources for activists that you should definitely go take a look at. Norman is based in the Bay Area of California, and he's been at this for many years. It's very exciting to have someone of his caliber on the show. You know, he's been at this for a long time, and he's got some really good insights about how to take action right now. That's what we do here. And the way I got connected to him was kind of funny. So back a little before the election, you know, I put out a special episode where I explained The way I got connected with him is kind of funny. So back a little before the election, I put out a special episode, a very special episode, where I explained my reasoning for voting for Biden, right? That episode was inspired by a very dumb Facebook conversation I had with someone I knew through comedy who made a lot of the arguments that I responded to on the show. The whole show was just a subtweet at that guy. But at one point, he tagged Norman and talked about how he failed the leftist movement under Bush or some shit. I don't know. But then Norman shows up in my shitty little Facebook thread and drops his own fucking article about why strategic voting is important, which was awesome. So I messaged him, and he was happy to do the show, so... He's a super nice guy, and just by number of years, he has way more experience than anyone who has been on Radicalize Me, including myself. I think you're going to enjoy this. So we're going to get right to it. I'm trying a new thing here. I want to see if we can keep the intros shorter so the interview comes in sooner. But about halfway through the interview, I'm going to pop back in and do a little talk about a topic like I would normally do at the beginning of the show. If you hate those segments, you can skip ahead 3 or 4 minutes and you'll be back to the interview. I just thought it might be nice to break things up a bit, right? Let me know what you think. You know, you're the one who has to listen, so you tell me. Anchor.fm/radicalizeme or radicalizeme@gmail.com. And one more thing before we get started, I promise. I'd like to invite you to subscribe to my YouTube music channel. Write down the name so you don't forget. It's... Ready? Joe Messina. If you're a longtime listener, you know I'm also a musician and songwriter. And while you won't find much on the channel right now, I have a new music video premiering on Friday, December 11th. It's a funny Christmas song about communism. That's all I can say, but you're not going to want to miss that. And now here's my talk with Norman Solomon. So you're in California.
Yeah. I'm just north of San Francisco on the coast.
Oh, very cool.
And what part of the country are you in?
I'm in Boston.
Yeah.
So I've spent most of my life in this, Northeast area, grew up in New York and Connecticut, lived in Philly for a few years and came here a couple of years ago. So, Yeah. How about you? Where are you from originally?
Well, I grew up around D.C. mostly.
Okay.
So I've been in California about 30 years.
Oh, wow. So yeah, you were in the thick of politics from the beginning.
Well, I was. I actually grew up at the time of the Vietnam War starting around D.C. So, yeah, that was pretty intense. You know, I got to go to some good demonstrations as time went on.
Yeah. So were your parents, did they share your politics mostly?
They were sort of liberal Democrats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine as well. Very cool. So, well, now you're, I'm sure you're doing several things, but I know, Roots Action is your group. Is that right?
Yeah. With Jeff Cohen, I co-founded Roots Action about 10 years ago and I'm national director there. I'm also, executive director of Institute for Public Accuracy, which is a 501c3. We give And actually, you might find it useful. We provide good sources to media.
Oh, okay. Yes, I'm actually very interested in that kind of thing these days. I've been thinking a lot about the end of the fairness doctrine and the explosion of right-wing media. So that is a very interesting topic to me.
Yeah, you might sign up at wordaccuracy.org. You just sign up as a media outlet. You'll get good leads and contact info for people to interview.
Accuracy.org.
Yeah.
All right. Very cool. So with that group, then what's sort of what is the job, like your job there, and what's the organization's job? Like, how do you sort of compile sources?
Oh, and are we taping yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I can start whenever you want to, but yeah.
Oh, okay, great. So at the Institute for Public Accuracy, we're really dedicated to providing sources to news media. I mean, across the board, large and small, left, right, center, whatever, sources that usually aren't seen or heard in news media. And so I'm really proud of, for 20 years now, the Institute for Public Accuracy has been providing those sources in a way we're offering people who otherwise just often won't get heard, seen, or read.
Right. Yeah, that's great. I mean, in doing this show, I really wanted to seek out some maybe lesser known and just less sort of connected sources who are not normally heard from. So that's great.
Well, yeah, in ecological terms, metaphorically, we might call it the understory. What doesn't get seen from the top is often totally obscured.
And right. Yet,
it's people's real lives, and some of the powerful movements that are growing are part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, my mission when I started this was to provide, you know, myself and any listeners with ways to get involved and ways to, you know, see themselves in the political struggles that that they're aware of. And I think, yeah, it serves that purpose much better when you're talking to these kinds of sources instead of just, you know, shows like The Daily Show or whatever. I love that show, but it, you know, they'll talk to big politicians. They'll talk to leaders of like giant organizations. You know, it's not something that people can always see themselves in.
Yeah. And there's a tendency, even some of the better shows, and sadly, some of the best quote unquote news is coming out of places like The Daily Show and, you know, Stephen Colbert and so forth. It's an interesting dynamic that when somebody in an elected position is on the program and interviewed, or someone like Thomas Friedman, say, from the New York Times, there's often an undue reverence by the host. You'll hear that too on an NPR program like Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
Right.
Again, just by example, Thomas Friedman or any number of other establishment media people are just almost fawned over. And given their records and the double standards on human rights, or the ways that outlets like the New York Times and Washington Post, or the New Yorker for that matter, supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003, just this calamitous, horrific attack on Iraq that's still having such awful consequences in human terms. And yet, that history is often ignored. And so we have a sort of a left-right mythology that somehow you've got the liberal media and the right-wing media. Well, we do, but a lot of the so-called liberal media is really an accessory to the corporate military-industrial complex.
Right. Yeah, there's not a lot of anti-capitalist news, I guess.
No, it's a sort of, you know, the system worked. And even it's interesting to me, if you watch CNN, which is completely anti-Trump and has been for quite a long time, often does some very good critiques of Trump, but challenging the underlying neoliberal system is just not on the radar. And the left edge of CNN is so mild and deferential to power. You know, who is on CNN from the left? Well, Van Jones used to be on the left. He's not anymore.
Yeah, not quite.
You just don't get these other voices.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what I always think about is, you know, they'll say they're showing both sides, but, you know, the supposed left or liberal side is, like you're saying, you know, it's Van Jones or it's someone from the mainstream Democratic Party. And then the right is the right. It's, you know, Hugh Hewitt or someone like yeah. that. I never see you on there. I never see Chomsky or Angela Davis or... yeah, it's just...
Well, it's interesting. Chomsky, I remember I attempted to ask Robert Siegel, who was then you know, a major host and producer, really, in effect, on All Things Considered on NPR. And I was writing an article about Chomsky that fortunately the Baltimore Sun ran. I believe it was his 70th birthday, like 20 years ago. And I asked Siegel at NPR, why is Chomsky not on your program? And he was very sniffy and huffy in his email back, which I quoted in the piece. You know, we don't have to have Professor Chomsky on. And that's pretty typical. I mean, I think that Chomsky was on the PBS NewsHour once.
Really?
And as FAIR, the Media Watch Group, commented, the world did not collapse. It was not a complete horror for the system, but they could not abide it at the PBS NewsHour. And it is fascinating. It's a good case in point. Even in European media or Asia or Latin America, Chomsky's just been all over mass media quite often in past decades, but not in this country.
Right. And that's one of the things that when I look at, you know, there's just everything is on YouTube. And when I see like kind of old TV programming from like, you know, when the Fairness Act, Fairness Doctrine still existed, there's just tons of these conversations, you know, maybe it's all just on like public broadcasting, but, you know, it'll be Noam Chomsky and William F. Buckley just debating. It'll be Angela Davis and some conservative. And that's something that we don't get a lot of these days. That's a very stark difference.
Often two sides that are not more than two sides. I mean, really, we know, Joe, there are 18 or 27
oh, sure,
or 56
yeah.
ways to approach one issue, and yet we know it's often boiled down to left-right. I know that FAIR is documented, and even then, back when there was a lot of debate a couple of decades ago on healthcare, I think it was during the time that Hillary Clinton was putting out her version right. as the quote-unquote first lady, and there were former Congress people, a Democrat and a Republican, who were regulars on All Things Considered or Morning Edition talking about healthcare options. They were both working for the insurance industry. You have a debate within a narrow frame, which is really, you know, if there's a paradigm, that's as clear one as any, that there just is not a wide range. And quite often we're told, well, you know, we need to give equal time to the right. The right have their own media outlets. They have right. Fox. They have these very big, powerful, actually multi-billion dollar corporations that are propagating the likes of Rush Limbaugh or you know, Tucker Carlson or other odious folks. But where is the amplification of people on the left? I mean, we are importantly spreading out, often using the internet, but still in all, we just don't have the financial horsepower to keep up.
Right. Yeah. What do you think it is that keeps something like Democracy Now! or The Guardian going? I mean, I know they're mostly funded by, you know, listeners and readers, but like, how is it yes. that they succeed where a lot of leftist media ventures fail?
Well, if we talk about Democracy Now!, I mean, that's been an overnight success that took decades, really,
right.
to gain so much prominence. It was absolute determination and talent Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, and they build an institution that, even though we know those names, there are dozens of people who are working full time. It was methodically built step by step. And it's wonderful what it is. We could benefit from dozens and dozens of programs with the reach that Democracy Now! has. And so it's all to the good. We have many other media institutions. I was thinking about that again the other day, that if you go back 40 years ago, 50 years ago, you had the Boston Phoenix in the area where you are, the Real Paper. We had so-called underground papers around the country, and they were the main means of communication. And then you had an outfit like Liberation News Service that would literally photocopy and put things in the postal mail, and then they would be typed out because there were no computers to speak of, and they would be published. And you had ultimately millions of copies at certain moments going out in a given week around the country, say around 1969 or 1970. Then if you were going to go into the 1980s, what was really the main means of communication among progressives or outlet for progressive left outlooks? It was primarily radio. And Pacifica Radio, the five Pacifica-owned stations, D.C., New York. Well, D.C. came in a little later, but New York, Houston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and then dozens and dozens of community stations that were Pacifica affiliates. And so that's how we heard Noam Chomsky, for instance, is that David Barsamian, with his program Alternative Radio, would syndicate weekly hour-long lectures and discussions from Chomsky and many other people on the left. And that was, in the 1980s, extremely important. And then, of course, in the 90s, gradually, the internet came in, and that lowered the barriers to entry to really be able to reach a lot of people. So while print has been important, I think, you know, clearly progressives are, have been and are learning to utilize the internet, which is, you know, going to be crucial, like it or not. It already is, of course.
I mean, that's one thing I see, is that there's a lot, there's definitely podcasting, but I think YouTube is more where I see like big leftist media personalities emerging. But I'm a little concerned that it's less, you know, problem the left seems to always have. It's a little less unified. So I guess I'm wondering, is that something you see as well? Do you see that changing at all? Is there a bigger leftist consensus building?
Well, there's a cacophony of voices, you would say, and, you know, to some degree that's healthy. I mean, a healthy forest has a lot of different aspects to it. At the same time, we have a lot of information and analysis, and there's some diversity of outlook. I think actually there's been a coalescence in the last few years that's been very healthy to my mind. But first I would say that the information analysis is crucial, and so is the organizing. And we've been stronger on the analysis and the information flow with programs like Democracy Now!, websites like Common Dreams, than we have been to organize effectively. And I think that's beginning to shift markedly and moving into the electoral arena more forcefully and effectively, I think has been very important. Yeah. And it's been a coalescence where, and that's where Roots Action was founded, because 10 years ago, we felt that while there was a lot of flow happening of information and analysis, there was much less strongly progressive action arm activity online. Yeah. We were frankly unhappy with Move On, which was very dominant at that point in terms of being an action arm. That. They were often an accessory, it seemed, of the sort of liberal elements inside the Democratic Party without being willing to challenge a war when it was being done by Obama. That sort of thing. And so Roots Action really grew out of the recognition that while we had these great information outlets that were growing, we didn't have corresponding strength in the action organizing realm on the internet. And I think that has improved as well, not only because of Roots Action, but other groups. In terms of coalescence, I think that the Bernie Sanders campaigns in 2016, of course, that means going back to early into 2015 or mid 2015, right, we have benefited from 5 years plus of the creativity, the political analysis and approach of the Bernie Sanders campaigns. And of course, that got us the squad. You know, we have your area, Boston, Congresswoman Presley. We have AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. We now have Cori Bush coming in to Congress, Jamal Bowman. This didn't come out of thin air. It's right, because there was this recognition that we have to organize inside and outside the electoral arena, and that includes winning elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something that I feel like Bernie understands. Well, you know, it's I get people's frustration that he's not just salting the earth and going full revolution. I think he knows what he's doing, because he knows that exactly what you're talking about is important, and he knows that his runs for president weren't just his runs for president, and they kind of sparked a lot of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So is Roots Action, is it sort of a networking space for people, or is it like, are you sort of like organizing movements and actions through it?
Well, really, increasingly both. Everybody's welcome to go to rootsaction.org and sign up for our action alerts. We do an action alert most days of the week, actually. And we started 10 years ago with zero people on our list. We now have in the U.S. 1.2 million who actively signed up, have done actions, and have stayed on. And we have increasingly been involved in electoral work. We frankly didn't feel there were many candidates for Congress with a chance to win who we felt comfortable supporting.
Right.
Likewise, presidential candidates. But we supported the Bernie Sanders campaign of 2016. We did make some public criticisms. I know I did some TV and radio programs saying, where's the foreign policy of Bernie Sanders? What happened to his willingness to challenge the military-industrial complex?
Right.
And there wasn't much of that. There wasn't much of foreign policy at all in his 2016 run. Yeah. He really improved during 2019 and 2020. We were part of criticizing him again publicly early on in his 2020 campaign back in 2019. And more he talked about the military-industrial complex. Bernie would say point blank, we've got to spend money on healthcare, education, and housing rather than finding more ways to kill people. And I think it's very important that he increasingly did that. One of our main points has been that if you're going to challenge corporate power, that has to include the corporate power that is making a killing, literally and figuratively, from the Pentagon.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. He did improve a lot on that. And I think it's important for people to recognize that, you know, Bernie isn't perfect. He was never perfect, but like he responded to the pressure from his base and from voters.
Absolutely. And another realm would be in terms of racial justice, where perhaps for reasons, including that he came from an overwhelmingly white state of Vermont, I'm not talking about his childhood in Brooklyn, I'm not talking about his political decades. And so he was, you know, he was slow on the uptake and was confronted by Black Lives Matter and other groups. And rather than just being defensive like Hillary Clinton was, he learned and he changed and he evolved. And the rallies I went to in California in the last year, the Bernie Sanders campaign, one in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco, and around the country, and we could see it and hear it on YouTube, as you say, and elsewhere. Right. He would talk about the prison industrial complex and systemic racism. And I really think that he developed very important ways to address it in terms of economic, social, and racial justice together.
Yeah. 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 He really got better at that. What are your thoughts on the, I guess, centrist or liberal critique of the left during this election and the accusation, I guess, that the more leftist like slogans and policies that were being talked about hurt Democrats in more conservative states? Is there anything to that?
Well, states and districts really do vary. At the same time, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has pointed out that people in swing districts, Democrats in the House, who were in swing districts, who advocated for Medicare for All and a Green New Deal, they all won.
Right.
And the political bloodbath among incumbent Democrats in the House who lost their seats were all so-called moderates. They were not people advocating. Now, the fact is, and I wrote about this, a piece that people could find on my website, normansolomon.com, or Googling my name on Common Dreams. I made the point that it was the corporate centrists of the Democratic Party who had control of the party messaging and the campaign messaging nationally. Right. They had the presidential candidate they wanted, Joe Biden. They had huge advertising budgets. They had an enormous national media megaphone, and they got to pump out their so-called moderate message, which was primarily that Donald Trump was terrible, which he is, and very little about economic issues, very little about advocating for working people, children, seniors, and so forth. So they got the campaign they wanted. And except for the presidential race, pretty much got clobbered. And then after getting clobbered, they say it's the fault of the left, which is their reflex.
Right. That's how it struck me as well. You know, I don't know, you know, I don't know much about South Carolina, but I do know that, it's still like in varied places where progressives are winning plenty of elections. So,
well, that was always, you know, going to be a long shot against Lindsey Graham, but Jamie Harrison lost by 10 points. It was tremendous amounts of money poured into his campaign. And Amy McGrath was a darling of the centrists in Kentucky. Right. And, you know, we had a Booker who ran there and almost defeated her in the primary, who was much more vibrant from the left.
Right.
So it's really hard to point to a lot of successes from centrists. You know, Hickenlooper in Colorado did win, but, you know, his opponent, Gardner, was, you know, known to be in trouble. So it's not that one size fits all, but I think what Bernie showed is that there is a tremendous support base for progressives that's been, to a large degree, untapped. And young people in particular, of course, in the primaries went overwhelmingly for Bernie. And that is the future, is younger voters.
Right. Hey, here it is, that new segment I told you about. I'd like to take a minute here to talk about right-wing extremism, and specifically, right-wing terrorism. I've gotten into a couple of stupid arguments online recently about right-wing terrorism in the U.S., and it occurs to me that I'm not sure anyone is taking it seriously enough. Left, right, and center, I think this country's failing to grasp how dangerous these people are. So, I'd like to take a minute and try to convince you. Now, in these discussions, it's always good to set some definitions at the beginning. The word terrorism can mean different things depending on who you're talking to. But when you're talking to me, I tend to go by the fucking dictionary. This is from Merriam-Webster. Terrorism is the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. Great. I hate when they do that. So what the fuck is terror? Violence, or the threat of violence, used as a weapon of intimidation or coercion, especially violent or destructive acts such as bombing committed by groups in order to intimidate a population or government into granting their demands. Okay, now I can already hear some of you saying, wouldn't this definition of terrorism implicate most governments and even some of the left-wing groups you agree with? And the answer is yes. I'll also add that I never said terrorism can't be positive, or at least useful towards positive goals. For instance, in the critically acclaimed RPG, The Outer Worlds, you travel throughout various space colonies, and depending on how you choose to play, you have the option to betray and assassinate the corporate executives and colony leaders who oppress their workers. in that pretend world, in that video game, you can certainly justify those actions, which serve the greater good. It's a very fun, make-believe video game. Regardless, left-wing terrorism is all but irrelevant in our case because, as you'll see, it hardly exists. But Joe, what about Antifa? What about BLM? I hear you, and I'm trying to get better about softening my tone with people who disagree with me. But if you believe Antifa and BLM are terrorist groups, you are dumb and wrong. I'm not saying that no one who identifies with those groups commits violence. Of course that's not true. We could easily assume that's not true, even if it weren't super easy to find several articles about BLM Antifas who did violence, so don't bother sending them to me. One of the most prominent examples is the guy who murdered a member of Patriot Prayer and then apparently started yelling, "I'm 100% Antifa," or some shit, which was definitely politically motivated, right? It's in Portland, I think. But the problem is, because of our government's right-wing bias in both major parties, right-wing extremists can intimidate the public multiple times with assault rifles, violently assault dissidents at Trump rallies, murder untold numbers of marginalized people through groups like the KKK or more discreetly through policing, and our leaders are still pontificating over whether they're terrorists. But one supposed Antifa guy kills someone, or a few people break windows, and they go, "Ah, see? Terrorists." Or they say thugs and anarchists like Obama and Biden. And of course, now that the Republican Party and right-wing media more or less openly support right-wing terrorism, this further legitimizes right-wing extremists and further stigmatizes all left-wing activism. Of course, this isn't true across the board, but I think it would be dishonest and not very observant to say you didn't notice this general trend. Next, let's talk about some statistics. The most jarring stat comes from a brief by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, titled "The Escalating Terrorism Problem in the United States." Right to the point there. I should make clear, CSIS is a purportedly centrist think tank, and those can be a bit slimy, but they seem to be very transparent about their sources and their funding, and their research looks pretty sound. I'll include a link where you can look at their methodology. I looked at the more left-leaning Southern Poverty Law Center for this piece as well, and I have to say, it set off several red flags when I couldn't find a single citation for any of their stats or claims. Also, a lot of the members of CSIS are former Republican politicians. There are plenty of Democrats too, but I just want to make clear, this is not some fucking like leftist operation manipulating data to make the right look bad. They say they compiled an original data set of 893 terrorist plots and attacks in the United States between January 1994 and May 2020. Quote, "Far-right terrorism has significantly outpaced terrorism from other types of perpetrators, including from far-left networks and individuals inspired by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda." You know, the ones we've been at war over for 20 years. It's more than that. Moving along. "Right-wing attacks and plots account for the majority of all terrorist incidents in the United States since 1994, and the total number of right-wing attacks and plots has grown significantly during the past 6 years." Huh, what's happened over the past 6 years? "Right-wing extremists perpetrated two-thirds of the attacks and plots in the United States in 2019, and over 90% between January 1 and May 8, 2020. This is the biggest takeaway from the brief, and you may have seen several articles about it since it was published in June. Those are significant numbers. Those are not presidential election numbers, right? This is two-thirds of the attacks in 2019 and over 90% in the first 4 months of this year. That's fucking insane. Let's look at the numbers now and compare right-wing terrorism to left-wing terrorism. The Guardian article, "Anti-fascists linked to zero murders in the U.S. in 25 years," created a little chart here with the CSIS numbers. And this is a little weird because it seems like they use anti-fascist and leftist interchangeably here. And those should be interchangeable, but they probably should have kept Antifa and the general left separate in the chart for the sake of analysis. I don't know. Also, please note that The Guardian published this 4 months ago before that self-proclaimed Antifa guy killed the Patriot Pair guy. That being said, according to the data, there have been zero victims killed in anti-fascist attacks since 1994. How many victims do you think died in right-wing attacks since 1994? Well, it's 329. Then they look at killings since 2010. Now, here's where they switch from Antifa to left-wing. Maybe they just didn't have leftist numbers for the 94 to 2019 period. I don't know. Again, the CSIS methodology, I think, is fine. I think The Guardian just kind of fucked up here. Nonetheless, since 2010, left-wing attacks have killed 21 people, while right-wing attacks have killed 117. They also add here that jihadist attacks have killed 95 people since 2010. Again, more from fucking white boys. Now, The Guardian says here, while researchers sometimes disagree on how to categorize the ideology of specific attacks, multiple databases that track extremist violence, including data maintained by the Anti-Defamation League and from journalists at the Center for Investigative Reporting, have found the same trend. It's violent right-wing attacks, not far-left violence, that presents the greater deadly threat to Americans today. Left-wing violence has not been a major terrorism threat, said Seth Jones, a counterterrorism expert who led the creation of CSIS's data set. This next part is from an article on Type Investigations. That's the site. The 87 people killed by far-right terrorists over the first three Trump years. 145 if we include the 58 killed in the October 2017 shooting rampage in Las Vegas. Far outstrip the 17 killed by Islamists or the 4 killed by left-wing extremists. Now, because it's, you know, numbers are important, but it's not all numbers. Let's get into the causes of right-wing and left-wing terrorism. What were their motivations? Back to The Guardian here. Most of the deadly extremist attacks in the... Most of the deadly extremist attacks the CSIS researchers categorized as left-wing were killings of police officers by black men, many of them U.S. military veterans, who described acting out of anger or retribution for police killings of black Americans. Many of the other left-wing attacks or plots in the CSIS database, including by anarchists, environmental groups, and others, resulted in no deaths at all. Often, left-wing plots, particularly by animal rights activists, have targeted businesses or buildings. And their primary weapons have been incendiaries designed to create fires or destroy infrastructure, not kill people, said Jones, the researcher who led the creation of the dataset. Interesting. Now, what drives the right to violence? Back to CSIS here. White supremacist networks are highly decentralized. Most believe that whites have their own culture that is superior to other cultures, are genetically superior to other peoples, and should exert dominance over others. Many white supremacists also adhere, in varying degrees, to the Great Replacement Conspiracy. The conspiracy claims that whites are being eradicated by ethnic and racial minorities, including Jews and immigrants. Brenton Tarrant, the Christchurch shooter in New Zealand, and Patrick Crucius, the El Paso Walmart shooter, espouse the most radical view of the Great Replacement Conspiracy, known as accelerationism. As advocated by Tarrant and Crucius, violent accelerationists claim that the demise of Western governments should be accelerated to create radical social change and establish a whites-only ethnostate. Okay, I'm back. It's Joe. Okay, so the left might kill police in retaliation for wrongful death, but mostly they attack buildings in the name of environmental or animal rights and avoid killing people, while the right are largely white supremacists who shoot up crowded places and want to establish a whites-only ethnostate. I guess there's two intellectually and morally equivalent sides to every issue. This is a super important distinction. All right, the right will tell you that they're not terrorists, even when they walk around armed to the teeth trying to intimidate government officials because they didn't do any property damage. But BLM protesters are terrorists because some of them did do damage. You've probably heard this ad nauseum lately, but let me make perfectly clear. People are more important than property. Right-wing extremists and the right in general have made very clear that they believe the opposite. Capitalism. It's in the name. They not only accuse the left of terrorism because of property damage, but they downplay their own attacks on human beings. Then they turn around and cry foul if one guy kills a Nazi and claims allegiance to Antifa. So don't try to play nice with these assholes. All right, if you're a living saint and you find that you have the ability to actually convert Nazis to real people, which happens, like some people can do that, go ahead. But in general, they are not to be negotiated and bargained with. This is the breakdown. There's Nazis, and there's everyone else. And now back to the show. So when it comes to, well, the way I got connected with you, was, a Facebook friend of mine, was actually not too happy with you.
There's quite a few folks who think that that is true. Matt.
Yeah. but yeah, cause I had, posted something where I said, okay, you know, I've come around and I feel like what we have to do is vote for Joe Biden. It's not, you know, the be all end all of politics, you know, who we vote for president, but let's get the less bad option in and keep doing the rest of it. And, this guy was kind of making that argument that it's better, like it's better for leftists under, extreme right wing, governments somehow. And, he cited you at one point. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, because you've seen this cycle go on a few times. What are your thoughts on sort of the strategic voting?
Yeah, well, first, the idea that it's better for the left, the worse it gets, I just think is dangerous and preposterous. I mean, yeah, bring on the Nazis, then the left will be really good before we're dragged off to prison.
Right.
I just think that makes no sense, and it's no message to the people who are suffering that they should suffer more, that there should be more cuts in healthcare, education, housing. So I wrote a piece a number of months ago that got a lot of response, and it said that the headline was to the effect that some progressives are in denial about the neo-fascist momentum of the Trump Republicans.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing now played out again for the umpteenth time just how real that is. I mean, Look at the mentality of the Trump people and how they're trying to deny the obvious about who won this presidential election. Can you imagine if the states that swung the election had swung a little bit differently and we were looking at another 4 years of Trump? I mean, this is a theme that Noam Chomsky focused on when he did the video that we featured in the launch of the Vote Trump Out campaign, which people can still see up there. Roots Action started in early August, Vote Trump Out at voteTrumpOut.org. And Chomsky was saying, with the far right in power, with Trump as president, we get nowhere in terms of policy. We hit a brick wall.
Right.
Whereas if we get Trump out of there and we get Biden in there, we have a possibility. We have some space. The left has potential to really change policy, which is what it should all be about. It's not about the number of people we can get out in a demonstration, although we should always strive to have big protests. It's not about increasing the subscription numbers for a magazine because we can stoke up more anger about a Republican president. It's about changing policy, and it's about fulfilling the two overarching responsibilities of the left, which is to fight the right wing, the xenophobes, the racists, the nativists, the misogynists, and also to fight for and implement a genuinely progressive program. And we're not going to do that with the right wing in power.
Right. Yeah. This is the sort of history of socialism and revolutionary action is something I've only started to scratch the surface of. But information I seem to have come across is that even someone like Vladimir Lenin was an advocate of participating in bourgeois electoralism when necessary. Like, there's just times where, like, you come up to that date on the calendar and you just have to make a choice, like, what's going to serve my goals the best.
Absolutely. You know, Molly Ivins is a great writer, a progressive writer out of Texas, who unfortunately has passed away, had a formula really early on in the 80s. And she said, in the primaries, you absolutely vote for your ideal who has any sort of practical way to win. But then we get to the general and we have to make those choices.
Right. Yeah. I see it as, it's always a harm reduction choice. There's no perfect way forward. I guess what you've probably had this conversation a million times. So, like, what do you tell people when they say to you that, you know, I don't want to, like, participate in the system anymore, and I don't want to support the corporatism, and, like, what is sort of your response to that?
Well, I agree with Chomsky again, who said in our Vote Trump Out video, it's not about how you feel.
Right.
This is not a therapy session. This is about how we can make change for the better. And the reality is that if we opt out of the electoral system, it's not about going to progressive heaven and saying, oh, I have not sinned by voting for somebody who was impure. It's about building movements and changing public policy so people don't suffer, and ultimately so militarism doesn't destroy vast quantities of lives. For those who are advocating a third party in the presidential arena or federal offices that are with partisan designations on the ballot, you, I think, can ask, what would have happened if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ran as a Green Party candidate in New York?
Right.
She would still be tending bar. There's nothing wrong with tending bar, but we're much happier with her being in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yeah.
Likewise, what would have happened if Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib had run third party? Likewise, they would not be in Congress. And there's a longer list of people where that's true. So people, as a practical matter, can say, oh, I don't want to associate with the Democratic Party, and we won't have anybody in Congress who advocates for us the way that AOC and Rashida Tlaib and others are doing really quite wonderfully. And there's a synergy between the movements and their presence in Congress that helps in both facets. Right. So people can, you know, be pure if they want and be ineffectual as a result.
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, one way I've thought about it is, because leftists who I have this conversation with will bring up the sort of, like, outside of electoralism stuff, like, what about direct action? What about this and that? And I agree with them. I'm like, yes, I think that we should all be doing those things. But as it is right now, like, I've done some work with our local mutual aid group, but it's hard to do because there's a pandemic that the government hasn't gotten under control. And right. I don't, you know, my work hours are not what they used to be. So I don't have the money to, like, front, like, food for people all the time. So, like, I'd much rather things be slightly stabilized so that we can do all those things.
Well, you're quite right, especially during the pandemic era, and hopefully in another year or so, we'll be freed up from that concern in terms of some of the public actions. I definitely believe we always need to do protests. We need movements that function outside of the electoral system and also intrude into the electoral system. There was that wonderful moment when Sunrise Movement did a sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office, and AOC had just been elected. She came and spoke to them. That was a pivotal moment that helped launch the Green New Deal as a national, widely discussed concept. And right. that is an example of direct action that intersected with the electoral arena.
Yeah.
I think, and this is sort of an anecdote, Joe, that I think is illustrative. In this debate, Daniel Ellsberg, the person who, of course, leaked the Pentagon Papers, has been an activist ever since in the last 50 years. The Pentagon Papers surfaced in 1971. Mm-hmm. And he wrote an article, and he was an endorser of our Vote Trump Out campaign, wrote an article that was widely read in Michigan, Detroit Metro Times published, vehemently advocating for voting for Biden, especially in swing states. And he was, of course, denounced as, you know, oh, you don't believe in protest. Daniel Ellsberg has been arrested more than 90 times
right.
for nonviolent direct action since releasing the Pentagon Papers. He's completely in that realm. Like so many other people, he recognized that it's not an either or. We need to organize and protest, demonstrate, and build social movements apart from the Democratic Party, apart from certainly the electoral arena as well. But also we need to get people in office who are pliant, who can respond.
Right.
And there's the example of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was not a progressive when he was elected in 1932. He was a deficit hawk. It was social movements that made the New Deal possible. But he wasn't an idiot. He wasn't a Trump. He wasn't somebody who was simply going to be a stone wall that we would hit our heads up against.
Right. Yeah. Do you see any... you know, I know candidates and president-elects tend to say things right before they get in office that they don't necessarily do. But do you see, like, any good signs from Biden, any sort of, like, concessions that you think might go somewhere?
The only good signs I see is that people are organizing.
Yeah.
We have to take a lesson from when people cut a lot of slack for Clinton when he came in, for Obama he came in, and the results was that Wall Street roared right into the administrations in terms of policy and the militarists as well. I frankly, at this juncture, don't see a lot of good signs.
Yeah.
We're told that Jared Bernstein, the progressive economist, will have some sway. Okay. I think there'll be some decent appointments to cabinet and so forth, but there are also going to be a lot of bad ones, and we're seeing like Cedric Richmond, the congressperson from Louisiana, has just been appointed to be director of the Office of Public Engagement. He's a shill for the oil and gas, the fossil fuel industry. There's a number of bad signs coming up. And that's just to me, and back at rootsaction.org, we are organizing, we're determined to fulfill the second part of our campaign, which was vote Trump out, then challenge Biden.
Right.
Collectively, we voted Trump out. Now it's time to confront the Biden administration.
Right. Because I think people rightfully fear the ongoing, like, moving of the goalposts of, like, well, don't criticize Biden now because he's running against Trump. And then, like, don't criticize him now. He's not even in office yet. And then it's like the midterms are coming and whatever.
There's always a reason.
I think that... you know, as with anything, I think people could stand to just turn off the outside voices a little bit and be like, all right, like someone's going to get mad no matter what you do. Like, just do
it. Yeah. I think, you know, there's much more of a foothold now in the Democratic Party, including in Congress, than we had just 5 years ago. Yeah. The leadership is better of the Progressive Caucus. We have Mark Pocan. We have Pramila Jayapal. Mm. And they're just tougher, and they're willing to put up a fight, but they have to be pushed because they're inside a milieu that is always about compromise, that is so distant from grassroots activism or being on our side of the class war, that we have to push them, we have to organize, and if necessary, we have to be willing to primary these Democrats who are not walking the walk. They're just talking progressive, they're not being progressive. And right. even that includes some progressive congresspeople who aren't really fighting. I mean, Congresswoman Presley in the Boston area, she's in Congress because she fought an incumbent who was not a corporate centrist. He was progressive. He just was not putting up enough of a fight.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think is this sort of unlike anything you've seen in the Democratic Party before? Because I'm curious, like, if you see any way forward for like third parties, or is this kind of the way to go? Because this is actually like a newfound energy that we haven't had before.
I think this is unprecedented in the last few decades in terms of the amount of progressive energy funneling into the Democratic Party in many state levels and getting results in terms of genuine leftists into Congress. I don't see any pathway for federal office, for Congress, for president, yeah. or for state legislatures for a third party. And the proof is in the pudding, or the lack of the pudding. When you've got party designation on the ballot, the failures have just been virtually complete. You can just ask yourself, how many Green Party candidates have been elected to Congress ever since the Green Party was founded a few decades ago? The answer is zero.
Yeah.
How many Green Party candidates have come close to being elected to Congress in the last few decades? The answer is zero. That ought to tell us something. And then we ask ourselves, how many genuine progressives have been elected when they run in Democratic primaries? And we've got a lot of numbers to look right. at. Not high enough, but they're getting higher and higher. On the other hand, when you have races for mayor, for city council, for county commissions and so forth, school boards, these are not party designated elections.
Right.
There's a lot of successes. And the value of something like a Green Party is that they can organize and build coalitions. I'll give you a quick example. In Richmond, California, three leaders of the Richmond Progressive Alliance were just elected to the city council. They've in the past been able to elect the mayor. Fighting Chevron, which is a terrible presence with the oil tank and refinery situation right in Richmond. That was done with Greens, with Democrats, with independents, with others working coalition. They didn't get territorial or worry about the party designation in their coalition. It was all about getting the job done, getting progressive policies enacted by getting progressives elected and holding their feet to the fire. So I think there is a space for the Green Party in nonpartisan races,
right.
Municipal and county and so forth. But the decision to run for president continually has just undermined that capacity. It's sucked energy. It's alienated people, understandably. I think the Green Party is going down just because of their fixation on running people for Congress and president.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how it looks. I mean, you know, I the first election I was sort of old enough to be aware of was 2000. And from there, it's just gone downhill. They don't seem to
Absolutely.
Get a lot of momentum.
It's too bad. It's really a shame.
Yeah. What do you think about ranked choice voting? How might that affect things? I think Maine has it and Alaska may have just passed it.
I think it's really important. At rootsaction.org, we have done a number of campaigns. We have messaged people in Maine and elsewhere where the decision on whether to have ranked choice voting is on the ballot as a referendum initiative. And so I think that is very important. A problem with, again, the Green Party approach is to act as though we have ranked choice voting when we don't. And to the extent that it can be put into place in different states, like as you say it is in Maine, that can change the dynamic. And so then you've got a different objective conditions to deal with.
Right.
So it's something to fight for, and we need to continue to do that.
Yeah. I think I have to get going in a minute, but is there anything else you want to put out there, or just like plug the websites again?
Well, I'd invite people to sign up for action alerts at rootsaction.org, and it's all a process. We also have something called DIY Roots Action, where you can set up your own petition action, and then we will help promote it if it has any sort of oomph to it. And often it does. So please come on down, because this is all about organizing.
All right. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. It was great to meet you.
Oh, same here, Joe. Looking forward.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I'll let you know when it's posted.
Please do. And let's be in touch.
All right. Thanks.
You take care.
And that was my talk with Norman Solomon. You can find him at normansolomon.com, S-O-L-O-M-O-N. Head over to rootsaction.org, and they'll help you join existing actions or start and promote your own. And accuracy.org for a database of useful sources, if you'd like to use them for your work or just read some news that you know you can be confident in. You can follow me on Twitter at @Joe_Messina, Instagram at @Joe_Messina1, Facebook.com/radicalizeme, and YouTube search Joe Messina. Don't forget to watch my new video premiering December 11th. Leave the show a voice message at anchor.fm/radicalizeme or email us at radicalizeme@gmail.com. And that's it. Bye now.